What's up, everybody? Thanks for tuning in to Beam Radio.
Welcome to Beam Radio. I am Lars Wikman, and I do not have a panel of hosts today, but I do have sponsors, and our sponsors, I will mention before we get to our very special guests, is Groxio, Career Fuel for Programmers. Bruce, what's happening at Groxio? Oh, he's not here. So let's move on. They're doing something cool. And I also know that Programming Phoenix Live ebook is coming along. So keep an eye out. Meanwhile, at Underjord, I'm sort of focusing in on creating Nerves Cloud, hosted version of the Nerves Hub project, which I'm making along with the Nerves team and my co-founder Josh Kildermis, and that's coming along really cool. And we do some consulting as well, you know, that kind of stuff. Now, we have some very special guests, and the first one is an old favorite. We had him on roughly 1 year ago from this recording date, and he told us about the upcoming, the exciting, the recently announced Ash 3.0. We have Zach Daniel. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
And we also have his co-author for the new Ash book that I'm dying to hear more about, Rebecca Lee. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, since we all already know Zach, or I hope most of you know Zach, and I hope you most of you know about like Ash framework, but we'll get into it if you don't. But we will like take the old episode if you want an intro, because we're going to do the new stuff, not the old stuff. We've heard the old stuff. But before we get into that, Rebecca, I'd love to hear about how you got into Elixir and sort of ended up working on this book. Where did that come from?
So I've been in Elixir. I've been working with the Elixir language since 2015, which I think I was one of the early adopters. I started looking at it in 2015 when I was looking for a new language to try out for this new advent of code puzzle thing that was new on the internet at the time.
Oh.
So I thought, this looks fun. I saw it was by Jose Valim from Ruby, because I was a former Rubyist before coming over to Elixir. So I picked it up, tried it out, loved it. And 9 years later, I'm still here, and I've been working full-time with Elixir since 2020.
All right. And where are you slinging Elixir these days?
I am working at Alembic with Zach and many other fine folks.
I thought you might. Yeah, the place that runs a lot of this Ash business. All right, Zach, that's your name. Ash's framework, the Zach framework 3.0. All right, Zach, can you get us a little bit up to speed? Like, I think last time we talked, you had the life of a function talk had just been given, and that kind of announced the 3.0, right? I think those correlate.
Yeah. I gave that talk in a few different formats, in a few different forms, but the first time I gave it was kind of talking about what's coming up in 3.0. And I think the timing works out there, based on the last time we talked on this podcast. It's actually kind of crazy just to think about how much has happened since then, like how much has gone into the tech itself, and all the new things that we've built, like, you know, all extensions, like not even necessarily related to Ash core. It's been a wild ride since then.
Yeah, and to be clear, Ash 3.0 did arrive, is that correct?
Yes, very much so. Ash 3.0 arrived. It was a pretty big hullabaloo. We found the upgrade experience to be like reasonable. Some people have had, you know, it took them a week or two. A lot of people said it was just a day or two. So probably just a barometer for like how complex the project in question is. Or, you know, how much it's leaning into certain to the things that changed. But overall, I'm glad it wasn't like this sort of like, you know, Rails 3, Rails 4, or, you know, Vue 2, Vue 3, in multi-month, multi-engineer upgrade stories.
Python 3, yeah.
Yeah, or even, isn't that one just still happening, right? Like, I don't know, last time I checked.
yeah, I think we're mostly through it, but there's still Python 2.7 out there. Yeah, probably some 2.6 as well.
Yeah, we still technically support Ash 2.0, but the window for that is closing quickly. So anybody who's listening to this podcast is still on 2.0, you should upgrade. It won't take you that long, and it's the new version is much better, much, you know, in a lot of different ways, and more optimized, faster, safer. Like, there's all sorts of little, you know, all sorts of quality of life, or I would say clarity, right? Like removing foot guns work that has been done. And, you know, like mass assigns, right? Like the old way that it's a classic thing from like Rails days where, like, you know, you'd have like, oh, I accept everything as input and pare down that list instead of accepting only specific inputs, and you have to. And so we solved that sort of thing. So it's just a better world in general. That was Rebecca, better actually. World. Fun fact, Rebecca was the one who originally was the impetus for that. I think partly because of her experience with Rails, but also experience working with Ash on projects, which is just that, like, the, you know, hey, this default isn't the right default. And that was one of, I think, her kind of really early pieces of feedback working with Ash. And we took a while, but we got it done.
Yeah, we changed a few things around that. Like, we flipped things to being private by default instead of public by default. And yeah, permitting specific attributes instead of allowing everything to be set. A lot of those kinds of changes went into Ash 3.0, 3.1, and so on.
Yeah, and I can see that fitting with what most people that gravitate towards Ash probably want it to be stricter by default, because you're partially bringing in to get like this layered security and this like tendency control, and it's has this very granular approach to security, and then being private by default and restrictive by default is probably the right call in many cases, except when it gets too annoying, which is always a fun trade-off.
Yeah, then that line is always one of those things too of like, I mean, Ash is really like very high leverage framework in a way where like any given line of code can, you know, actually result in significant change. And so like, because of that, like that's one of those things, that's a double-edged sword, right? Like that means like leverage means high power, but also high risk, right? So like if you change the type of an attribute, you know, we're inferring the type in your GraphQL, right? And so you have to watch for these things. You have to be more careful. I would suggest that it's like worth it. That design pattern is worth it, but requires new methodologies for making sure that like your application doesn't change in unintended ways and things like that. And so like, yeah, we have to be secure by default. Like a good example is like, you know, we have a policy authorizer, and like we were theoretically, like we didn't have to do it this way, but as soon as you use policies, and you make like you try to do an action, at least one of those policies that you've defined has to apply to the action, otherwise we'll fail the request. And so that like prevents, you know, thinking, well, oh hey, there's no policies about this, so we're gonna like let you do it, you know, fail closed versus fail open, that sort of thing. And so we try to do that everywhere.
So someone would have to define a policy that is allowed by default, essentially, to
exactly
to get that behavior, which seems doable, but means you get the safe default.
Yeah, you generally wouldn't want to do it. You know, it's like you could write a policy that applies to all requests, that authorize all requests, and because every policy that applies has to pass, that it's safe to do that, to make it, to turn your policies into a, you know, a deny list instead of an allow list, but, you know, but wouldn't suggest it, but you could.
Yeah. All right. But with a Rails background, Rebecca, that means you can answer the question, like, is Ash framework the Rails for Phoenix? I know just Zach just loves that comparison, I'm sure. Has never heard it before.
It is a very different approach. It takes a lot to wrap your head around what Ash does, but it gives you so much more power than the Rails model, active record, that whole ecosystem. It gives you a lot more power than that does. It gives you a lot more control over what you're doing. You're not limited to, I have a create, I have a save, I can add hooks on create or save, and that's it. It's a lot more powerful. The learning curve is a lot steeper, but overall, I like it more.
Yeah, it is interesting. You're right. I do get that question a lot, or people will compare it in some ways to either Active Record or, I mean, the worst one I get is Active Admin, we have an admin UI. If that's the closest that we get, really, you know, but it is really interesting. And this is something I realized, like we've often had difficulty communicating what Ash is, because what it looks like if you look at what a resource is, you will, I think, typically be taken down the wrong path. Like if you don't actually try it out on something with some even just a modicum of complexity, if you don't look more deeply into it, then it looks kind of like this like a sort of CRUD framework, hey, let's build an API quick and throw some CRUD in there. And, the thing is, like, people building Elixir and Phoenix apps, like, they're not bad at building APIs. Like, the tech to do that was already there, so they're just like, why bother, right? So it can be difficult to kind of explain that that value prop. But I think one of the things I realized that I don't think we really emphasize is, like Ash is, like, it's all still in Elixir. It's a functional programming language. It's all still immutable. Like, ultimately, that is the number one reason why we can build something like Ash and not have it be as in my opinion, problematic as something like Active Record, right? Is that we don't have the option to, like, mutate your objects that you have references to or any other sorts of things like that. Ultimately, you call functions do things, and, it's as straightforward as any other Elixir code in that way, right? So I think that's what sets it apart from things in other languages, is that, like, we're building on a solid foundation, and we don't have the opportunity to even do certain kinds of bad things that other tools like this do in other languages.
Yeah. I think for me, one of the just exciting things about the structure of Ash is, well, it's this high leverage thing. Like, I've tried to generate UIs and sort of structural information based off of Phoenix apps, and it is just, like, missing a lot of stuff because they're not built for that. You can derive some stuff from schemas. That's about it. Like, there are some other things as well I think you can do, but you don't have the sort of option to in any real rich way see, okay, what can I do with this? How does that work? What inputs would it take? Like, oh, do I need to have a sort of file upload field here, or could I do something else? And I think something that's like, yeah, that will let you generate an admin interface. It will also let you generate an API endpoint. It will also let you generate your whole API, but it might also let you generate your CLI and your, like, everything sort of will map to the same application layer structure. And the limited work I've done with Ash, something I realized very quickly was, like, oh, when I'm dealing with a resource, which is sort of the equivalent of schemas, like they model data and stuff. So, like, there's no reason to write an action called create unless you want the most generic action possible, there is a type of action called create, but that's sort of to know whether it's a creative or destructive action, I think. Like I haven't looked into what the types of actions do, but I know that when you define an action, you also define whether it's a create, update, or delete, or whatever. And but essentially, you're encouraged to model your domain with fairly specific actions, and suddenly it's kind of like contexts, but much, much more structured, which I thought was interesting and practical.
Yeah, it is. It's very interesting that you observe that. Like we found, you know, what I found is interesting is like some people kind of start to, I don't know, some people grok it or to some degree, and then to some people it like remains magical, which is a problem on our end, right? Like that's not. Mm-hmm. I think we have a lot of things to do, and we're gonna talk about this, right? This is part of why the book is happening, right? We have a lot of things to improve on our onboarding experience and our documentation. But you know, you talk about driving things from your domain, and I think like this is one of those things of like I did this at the ElixirConf, my ElixirConf talk. Everybody was talking about like AI and you know assistance and you know RAG, like retrieval augmented, whatever, I forget whatever that is.
Yeah.
You know, data, and I was like, you know, I've got this whole definition of an application. Surely I can just make an agent, you know, that can use my app for me. And I did it in like 2 hours. Like I did it the night before my talk and I demoed it at the talk and it worked. And what's so interesting about it is we already have the tools to do it because we, if you're using OpenAI, for example, you give them like a JSON schema of things that the bot can do, right? And then
yeah,
can
right. Say, they're okay, function calling API type of thing.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we already have for AskJSON API, we have open API generation. So I can take any action interface and I can say, here's how you call it, right? And then the beauty of it is I say, here's the user that's doing it. And the robot doesn't have a chance to change who is acting, right? The actor is always by us provided whenever any action is called, which means there's no privilege escalation possible, right? So it's always, you have some user who's using your app. You could slap up a chat window and you could say, okay, well, here's all the actions that this chat window can take, right? That will automatically adapt as the inputs to those actions change in your actual thing, in your actual app. And you can just, it can just use your app for you. So in a Twitter example, I could say things like, you know, hey, create a post about how cool Jose is. And then I could say like, actually, can you create a new post that directly contradicts my last one? And it like runs a query because it knows I gave it a schema for queries. So like saying, okay, I'm going to run the read action for tweets to get this user's most recent tweet. Like it figures all that out for you. But because you have your application defined, that's the reason that was easy. That, and also, you know, GPTs are magic, but the fact that I could just leverage that, it really, you know, I think what developers should really identify with that is like, hey, when your PM comes to you and says, we need to slap AI on this thing, how much of your app are you going to have to rewrite to make that work? Right? Like how much crap are you going to have to put on the inside of all of these things to like, let the robot do it. Right. Or all that sort of stuff. Right. And the answer to me is zero with Ash. It's on GitHub, Ash AI. It's a toy, but you can try it out and we may actually get it sort of, you know, more prepared, but it's literally zero lines. You add the dependency and then you can chat with your app. Like it's pretty crazy.
That's a good demo. Now you actually made me have to consider Ash for a thing because I wanna add a command palette to an app, which means actions on resources and contexts and all of that. And I was like, yeah, I need to figure out what can I actually do in this app, and like retrofitting that onto an existing app means either maintaining some lists or like, I guess I'm gonna do macros in my router. Like, what am I doing here? Now I need to think. All right. But you mentioned the book. What's this about a book? What are you doing?
We are writing a book. We hope to see it in beta by the end of the year. So we are, Zach and I are both writing a book with, that will be published by Pragmatic Bookshelf, tentatively titled Building Web Applications with Ash. So we are going to provide a live view app that users can then clone and see what the app looks like. And then we'll build up the domain model in the app step by step, covering all different pieces of functionality in Ash. So we'll be looking at resources, relationships, calculations, aggregates, authentication, policies, PubSub, everything, as much as we can fit into 250 pages.
So it's going to be, if I know the Pragmatic approach, it will essentially be a full reference tour tutorial.
Hopefully that is the goal.
Yeah.
It's also worth pointing out that Rebecca is doing most of the writing. To date, actually, Rebecca has done all of the writing. I have done lots of review. But my job is, so Rebecca's work with the book is acting a lot like a whetstone as she goes through all of the different, like, okay, well, here, now having started with these things, let's add this. And it's like, well, hey, this works differently here. This is a bad experience, or this doesn't map well to, you know, or like getting started with this took like four steps that didn't seem necessary. So we'll talk a bit about Igniter maybe after we talk about the book, because that, a lot of that, the impetus of that came from Rebecca actually doing what the users will have to do to write, you know, as a process of writing the book.
Oh, that's such a good kind of takeaway, because like, make your developers use the thing and especially try to explain the thing, and they're like, ah, are all these steps really necessary? and that's how you start to get either really good developer experience or really, really weird scripts. But so
the framework for a period, it went through what we call book-driven development, because we went through a lot of the onboarding, getting started stuff. And previously, before Ash 3.0, there was a lot of copy-paste this, and it really wasn't a good experience. So that's where the idea for Igniter got pushed forward. So we can talk about that a little bit. So that's scripts that we write, scripts that are written to generate code for you. So it really smoothed the onboarding process, and we lean on it a lot to generate code, but then explain the code, go through the code. Here's what this code does.
Let's get into Igniter, because Igniter is super, super interesting. And also not necessarily just an Ash thing, right?
Yeah, it's published in the Ash project umbrella, but Ash uses Igniter, not the other way around. And it's actually pretty interesting, because I'm used to, you know, Ash has been it's not divisive, but people have a divisive, what's the phrase for that, right? Like, some people love it, some people hate it, whatever the words I'm looking for there. And with Igniter, everybody who actually uses it, like, and experiences like the UX of using Igniter to as like an end user generating code, calling an Igniter command, they're like, oh yeah, this is way better than what we had before. And then when you actually like write your generators using Igniter, it's really powerful. It's one of those things, it's like everybody who uses it actually likes it. Like, and I'm like not really used to that type of reception to the things.
You're
that
coming in ready for a fight and just like, I'm gonna explain to you why this is good. And they're like, seems good.
Yeah, exactly.
Welcome.
So this is, I want to be really careful here, because it was just one conversation about it at ElixirConf, but I did actually do a whole pitch session with Chris McCord on getting the Phoenix generators to be sort of reworked to be based on Igniter. So one of my, I know I'm kind of putting the cart before the horse, because I haven't told our dear listeners what Igniter actually is, but I think he's interested, and ultimately we're just going to have to do a trial and a pilot. And, you know, lots of people use Phoenix, and it's got to be really airtight for him to consider, you know, bringing in a new piece of tech to the tooling of the framework. So I totally understand that. But he, I mean, even he, as he was using, he's like, yeah, that's really cool. That's a really great experience. So I'm hopeful. I might actually, I have so many things to do, but I feel like I should do that one soon.
I can understand the a little bit of Chris-driven development. So I guess we will get into what Igniter is. But is it fair to say that it would potentially solve one of people's big concerns with like Phoenix Genauth?
Yes. I think it can. It solves a problem with code generation in general. However, it doesn't solve the fact that generated code is still like your problem, right? Any code that you generate with a generator is, you know, at the end user's problem. However, it decreases some of the risk. Let's explain what Igniter actually is, because in order to go for that. So Igniter is based off of the sort of fundamental thing that makes it work is a tool called Sorcerer. And what Sorcerer does, and this is not my tool, I forget the person's name. I know their internet handle, Dorgan is their handle, but I forget what their real name is. But it's amazing. It's an amazingly well-written tool, really like it. And so what Sorcerer does is it parses Elixir AST and then allows you to manipulate the AST and then turn it back into source code. So for those who aren't familiar with what AST is, it's an abstract syntax tree. So if you've ever written a macro in Elixir, the like big block of tuples, you know, that you see that is like what source code looks like sort of under the hood, that's the AST. And it's basically the data structure that you're actually implicitly writing as you write code. So like when you call a function, that's like a three tuple where the first thing is like the name of the function. And the third thing is like a list of arguments to the function. But the important bit is it's a manipulatable data structure. So what you can do is you can go find patterns in that structure and you can replace them with something else. And you're doing, instead of, now you're not doing like a regex find and replace or anything like you're actually doing it with a data structure. And so Sorcerer also comes with a data structure called a zipper. And a zipper is a tool that lets you actually, it's sort of like a functional approach to working with trees, where you can have like a you know, you're a point in the tree and you can go down and up and go find something and have like a sort of position inside of the source code. So built on top of this, the thing is that that's actually very difficult for a sort of layperson to use. You have to really understand the Elixir AST, you have to understand zippers and trees, and it is hard. And so what we've done with Igniter is a couple things, but primarily we actually provide a much higher level interface to work with a zipper and like some section of source code where you can say things like go to def module, and then go to a function called, you know, Fred that has two arguments, and then go to the first argument, and then you can say like replace it with this value. And so you give this sort of like semantic procedural approach to modifying source code that isn't really complicated, you know, have to understand exactly what the representation of all of those things looks like under the hood, et cetera. So that makes our tooling what we call source patching, not code generation. That's like the better phrase for it is source patching, where we may make new things, but we also have the ability to smartly modify existing things.
Code mutation.
Yeah. So an example of this is like, we have a high level interface, even higher than like that code manipulation I was talking about. We have a project level interface. So I can say like project.configure, and you give it like say config.exes. You say, I want it in that file. And I want to set, you know, like my app repo name database URL to this string. And like, we already have built into Igniter what this, like, how, what a config file looks like, what are the rules of modifying config, and we go find, like, where it does it already exist, does it exist like partially, and so we're just going to put the value into the keyword list, or does, you know, all that sort of stuff. It's I'm telling you how complicated it is because I'm telling you what it solves for you, but when you use it, yeah, it's actually quite simple. You just say set this configuration to this value.
I recall looking at it and seeing like, oh, there's stuff here for manipulating the mix project itself and kind of just like, oh, actually pulling out the, just like pulling out the app name or changing things about the basics of the mix.exs file and all of that. And also like getting into config stuff that every app has and needs to some extent. And then like slightly more generic stuff for tackling source files.
Yeah. So I've started with actually what I would say, like kind of the boring bit. So armed with these big tools for source patching, we have another layer that is sort of how you actually use this as an end user, which is a sort of enhanced mix task. So these enhanced mix tasks have two main things, which is that they are kind of like, if you're familiar with plug, you know how you like take a con, you return a con, these take an igniter and return an igniter. And that igniter has a bunch of staged changes to source code. And you like add more staged changes to the source code. You can like remove files, delete files, do all this sort of stuff, right? And then we can display to the user like, okay, here's all the proposed changes, and you can break your you know your source patching up into like functions and you know smaller tasks that will make smaller changes, and then you can build them up into like one big patch. And as the end user, especially this comes into play when you want to just like install a new package. This is like, this works today. This is the recommended way to install Ash, is you say mix igniter.install Ash. And what that will do is that'll check hex for like, what's the latest version. It'll put like a pin to the major version in your mix.exes file. Like it'll patch it and it'll say, hey, I need to save this change because I need to go download that dependency and look and see what it has. So you say, yes, I'll do that. And then it mix steps compile. And then it says, well, hey, does this have a task called ash.install? And if it does, then it's going to run that installer and it's going to queue up like, here's all of the setup that is involved in running in like adding this ash dependency. So we have done this for like four or five of our packages. I'm still working on some of the, you know, other ones. Ash authentication is a big one, but we have tabs now on the setup guide where there's like with igniter, you know, setup is like with igniter and manually. The manually one is like 25 manual steps. And the with igniter one is mix ash dot inst- or mix igniter dot install ash. Like it's a really good experience and they're additive. So if you come back and you're like, actually, I also want Ash Postgres, you say mix igniter dot install Ash Postgres. I'm like, I want to make a GraphQL now. And you install GraphQL. And one of the big problems that we have with mixphoenix.new is you have to make a bunch of choices way up front, like before you're even really sure what you're doing.
Yeah, that was a bit of a path first using Ash. Like, I'm very comfortable with Phoenix. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't that big a problem. But also I had to follow like three different Ash guides cover the specific parts of Ash I wanted because I don't want all of them, and actually adding all of them would have been even more work because you need to hook it in to particular parts. But there's pretty strong conventions actually about how this stuff works in Phoenix, so patching it in should be fine for most cases. Like if you have a very modified old Phoenix code base, actually, how does Igniter handle failure?
It cries in the corner. No. So the idea is that source patching is like a best effort thing, right? So any source patcher, like the way you write it, if you're going to like say modify some module, like the functions will almost, you know, almost all of them will have like a return that's like an error or a warning. So like an error will actually stop the igniter from actually doing the commit. It's like something went sort of catastrophically wrong. But a warning is just like, hey, we made these changes. And here's some stuff you're going to have to do by yourself because we couldn't figure it out. Your code didn't look the way we expected it to look. And so we couldn't do it. So it, that's generally the way that it handles failure. There's a couple little things I actually need to fix on my own igniters where I'm not handling failures nicely, but the tools are there for handling failures gracefully when you're using Igniter. And I think like, I really want to extend this experience to Phoenix itself. I don't think that I was not really able to sell Chris on the idea of like rewrite of the default mix Phoenix new being nothing and then like adding things. But I think that we could probably have like a mix phoenix.new --no, like without everything. And then you could run, you know, if it's written with Igniter, you, there would then be individual ones for each little bit. But I really would want to be, I mean, what does anybody even really know what an empty Phoenix application with none of the other tidbits look like? Like any, like, I know, I'm sure that Chris does, right? But how cool would that be to be able to say, mix Phoenix new, my app, and you get nothing but like a simple web layer. You don't have views, you don't have HTML, you don't have live view. All you have is like, you know, the router and, you know, controllers probably, right? And then to say, okay, install live view. And see, here's all, you get a diff. Here's what LiveView modifies about your project for it to work. Like that sounds like a wonderful experience from an onboarding perspective.
Yeah, there's actually a feedback I've heard about Phoenix a number of times. It's like, oh, there's too many files. And I'm like, usually I've sat down with the person at that point and gone, okay, this is that file. This is that file. This is that file. And when they look at it, it's like, yeah, okay, all of those need to exist. It's like, oh, this is your web server. The endpoint is your web server. And like, then there's a router. And well, this is your actual application file. And oh yes, there's some get text stuff. Why is there get text stuff? Because at some point you're gonna need it. Like, but skipping some of that by default could be quite nice, or at least, actually, can Igniter run in reverse? Tailwind by accident,
You'd have to write an explicit uninstaller. It's a fun idea, but because they are scripts still, they're like source traversal, you know, so like, but we tried. I tried to write a declarative source code patcher that could be reversed, and I think it's like mathematically not possible.
I think you should shop this around to a few universities and just let them go off and see what happens.
It would be pretty interesting. We could add it later as a thing. Like if we have like this declarative format of a patcher, and then it would generate two tasks from the declaration, you know, so we wouldn't have to change how Igniter works now to support automatically reversible patchers at some point.
But the idea of putting Igniter in like the Phoenix, it's, that is really interesting. I've seen you talk about Igniter for essentially migrating dependencies. So I guess that's updating a dependency.
We'll have Igniter for thing. Like Ash 4.0, we'll have a mix ash.upgrade, you know, Igniter task. So I think that would be really useful. And
did
I think
you just,
you know,
spill the beans on Ash 4.0.
Not anytime soon. I did the last, I think I spoke about this publicly, I mentioned that we had no good reason to do 4.0. We do have a good reason to do 4.0. There's a couple little things that have come up that would be breaking changes to introduce, and so we have a classic strategy of like, we implement a config option that tells us to use the old behavior that we want to change. And then in the getting started guide and the Igniter installer, we set it to like use the new behavior that we actually like. So like we can kind of do this thing where it's like all of the changes that would be in 4.0 are already in 3.0. They're just opt-in with config. And then 4.0 will just be removing the option of setting those configs. So people who didn't upgrade along the way will have to upgrade. So there will be a 4.0 at some point. It won't be significant.
But migrations of source, so that's a fun thing for Phoenix. Like when Phoenix drops a decently sized update, usually there are a bunch of things you need to check, the usually very thorough and useful notes. we're like, okay, you can change this. If you want to use this, you have to add this. And then you can update your Phoenix and get all the new goodness. Having that just be like Igniter upgrade or whatever, Mix Phoenix upgrade, that would be kind of rad.
Yeah. One of the things that I talk about, and this is, I focus on the ElixirConf talk as well, right? Is like, we, for declarative design, you favor data over code, right? Which, this is one of those great examples. When you look at an ASH resource, it's just data, right? Like the resource itself is just defining this data structure that we read later. It doesn't like do anything in isolation. But because it's data, data is significantly easier to patch than code. And I mean, in a way it's code, technically it's an Elixir file, you know, but like it has a prescribed structure that's statically defined elsewhere. We know what we're looking for. We know how to, you know, make changes to that source code. And so what that means is if we changed an option name, like writing a patcher that would find all of your resources and change like some option from, you know, some other thing to some new thing, it would be effectively perfect, right? Like there wouldn't be cases where it could be wrong because it's not having to find like, there's no version of like apply where you like don't know what the module is or the function name is like upfront, like where you have this dynamism. We don't have that in when you're dealing with a data structure. So I think that's an advantage of using something like ASH, is your app isn't just like 1,000 modules and arbitrary function calls that you made up. Because if you want to make some sweeping change to that, it's like, good luck, really, right? Like it's a very difficult thing to write an upgrader for.
Yeah, I'm thinking very much about building a generator right now, just trying to build something that gives you nerves plus a lot of bells and whistles, including Phoenix.
Yeah.
Which means marrying two generators. And that's really annoying.
Yeah. So we do have a solve for that actually right now. It makes things play kind of nicely together as best as they can, which is there's also a mixigniter.new task that will create a new app and install a bunch of things. You can also say --install install to install a bunch of things. We don't just install stuff for no reason, but you can say mixigniter.new --with phoenix.new. And it will call phoenix.new for you and then install whatever you wanted to install. So if you're like if you're trying to write a getting started guide that's like, here's like Phoenix plus nerves plus whatever, right? If as long as you can build yours on top of a Phoenix app, then you can have that experience of like a one-liner command that creates exactly what you want. If you can't though, if it's gotta be like, you know, if it's special in some other way, then you'd have to wait until we have Igniter stuff in Phoenix.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess what I would ideally want is to add my own patches on top of nerves.new and phoenix.new, which is, I guess, a little bit more challenging. But it still means I would be able to grab some, like, I'd only need to write one of the generators, essentially, which is a good start, or at least do less work to marry them, which would be
a good thing. I think that's the interesting thing. I believe in mix new, right? I don't like Phoenix new or Ash new or Nerves new or whatever, right? All of those, in my opinion, should be installers into a app. Like, so you have an app, an Elixir app, and you install Nerves or you install Phoenix, right? And I think that's kind of the big thing, is it's like, it was unreasonable to provide a really good experience around that installation. Whereas with, you know, when you say mix, when you take over the whole new creation of a project, you're in control. There's no conflicts, right? Like you're creating all of the files. So I think with something like Igniter, and with lots of different projects out there building their generators using Igniter, all of a sudden we have this nice like composable library of little bits and bobs to choose from to generate your projects. And it's actually reasonable to do something like, hey, I have this Elixir app. I modeled my domain using Ash, or I have some stuff using Ecto, right? And now I want a web server for it. Like I should just be able to like install Phoenix. I shouldn't have to. What people do today, this is how it actually works. You mix Phoenix new and you copy your old application inside of mix Phoenix new. like by hand. And that's not a good experience. So I think that's the idea we want to get to, is like, you can just start with an empty Elixir project and build it up with, you know, and the whole ecosystem, right? So that's where we want to get to.
Well, it's very exciting. And I need to poke this more. I wonder how much work it would be to make essentially a library installer for Nerves. Nerves has some opinions about project structure because embedded, but
yeah, I think that's actually, somebody was asking about this, like the poncho structure of that they go for.
Yeah, that was like that was me.
That was you. Okay. Right.
Yeah. And honestly, right now I wouldn't build using the poncho structure. I would rather merge like a Phoenix project and a Nerves project. And I've done that by hand and figured out how it needs to work and like get all the necessary bits playing well together. But it's a pain, and I don't want other people to do it. And I also don't want other people to just like have to clone my project to get going. Like that's okay for the enthusiasts playing around with it or like following along at home, but it's not a really good experience.
Yeah.
And all the projects end up named the same.
Oh yeah, they do, don't they? Because they fork a repository, and it's like,
yeah, but it's just like, how much finder replace do you want to do?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, I think ultimately, you know, this is the beginning too. We talked about like, you know, what we're talking about, like why the book's coming up, why we're working on these. So Rebecca spends a lot of time supporting the community and in addition to working on the book. And ultimately, this is like the big beginner of trying to like really solve DX problems. Right. We're starting at this getting started, but there's so much more that we can do to help, like, you know, with generators that help you not make mistakes and all that sort of stuff. And I'm sure, like, I guess it's kind of interesting because, you know, Rebecca, you did the igniter or the generators for the books, but have you used them on your projects yet? Like, have you used the generators for any of those things?
I have. I was looking at just the basic igniter.install. I'm like, we can do that now, because at work we recently updated one of our projects to Ash 3, so we can now use igniter and all the bells and whistles that come with it. So it's like, I can just run igniter install now and I don't have to do any of that stuff, and it made me happy.
That's cool. Yeah, I think also like the context there is mixigniter.install works for things that don't have installers. It'll just add it into your mix.exes file. So even just that little tiny bit is like a nice experience of like, it's like when you say npm install and it just like patches your package JSON, right? That's a nice experience. So we have,
you
that
mean
same
I,
thing
I
for
Elixir don't, now. You're saying I wouldn't want to just go mixhex.info dependency name, carefully select the part where the latest version is, and then find and paste that into deps get or in correct. My deps, and then add a comma.
Right. Yeah.
Forget the better. Comma, run mix deps get a compile error, and then add the comma. Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
The one benefit of doing it that way is that you actually see what it is you're installing first. Maybe that's something we can add to Igniter to be like, is this actually the package you want to install in case you make it wrong or something like that?
That's an interesting point. Like if you typo the package name, we're just going to say, like we do ask you to confirm the change. But like when you do mixhex info, you see like, I think you see a package description and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So it would be, it's an interesting point of like mixigniter.install could show you like, you know, here's descriptions. Probably what we should do, this is what I would like. Okay, I have, this is a slightly tangent to how this works, but I think it would be really nice. And I don't know if you've noticed on like really big Phoenix projects or just Elixir projects in general, when you have like 50 dependencies, you end up organizing them, right? You end up grouping them together with comments, and you say like, these are my Phoenix, these are my Ash depths, these are, you know, markdown parsing, these, right? So I have an idea that I want to propose to make it like a just a standard thing, which is like a category that you can select out of like a list of known categories when publishing a hex package. And then when MixIgniter installs it for you, it will put it in the section under a comment with the category name, so that like your MixX's like stays organized. And then we can also even put a comment above the dependency that's the description of the library you just, because there's a one line description available for all hex packages. So we could just comment above it in the generated code. Like, so you could see like Phoenix, and then you'd see like Phoenix, and it would be like, you know, a blazing fast web server or whatever that description is. And then you'd see like Phoenix HTML, and it'd be like HTML utilities for working with Phoenix, all that sort of stuff, right? Like, and your depth file would actually be like much more informative and organized instead of like what it can become today.
Peace of mind from prototype to production.
There it is. That's what it is.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't hate it. I think comments above every depth might get a little bit much in the specific projects you're talking about, where you also need to organize your things.
Right. Yeah.
This gets like, very long file.
Yeah, your 50 lines of depths is now 100 lines of depths, like just because, yeah, for comments. That's true.
Yeah. But it's interesting. And yeah, just being able to install packages. Like, I bet someone will tell you that we're going to have the problems of NPM and the node ecosystem now that we can have a single command install of packages. I am inclined to disagree because we don't make very, very tiny packages and we don't churn quite so aggressively.
Well, and you can only have, I think people don't realize this. They don't realize how big a deal it is to why your application works so nicely just in general with Elixir, is that you can only have one version of any package installed at any time for any dependency. Mm-hmm. Like in Node, with NPM, you can have like the same dependency, but like 50 different versions installed.
Yeah, nested.
Yeah, exactly. Like it's crazy, right? And it's like, yeah, we have to front load the complexity of handling that when you have two things that want the same dependency. But as a byproduct of that, your application is way smaller, way more easy to reason about. You don't have like the same versions of code. I mean, we couldn't do it that way if we wanted to, but that's a good thing, is my main point.
Yeah, we would also run out of like application name atoms if we did things the Node way. It's just like every dependency is an atom and you'd run out.
Yep. So that's a constraint that ultimately helps us in the end.
Yes. It forces. It's what is it? Constraints are something creativity.
Mm-hmm. That's the exact quote.
Yeah, something is the load bearing bit. All right, I think we should start wrapping up. But I'd be curious to hear about what you would tell people is kind of the most valuable or the hardest part that like Ash solves for you that you think people might not be aware of, because I know you do a lot of tricky stuff for people in Ash. And I'd be curious to hear what you think is the thing you're solving that people would maybe not even be able to solve on their own typically.
Oh, that last part does. So it's an interesting question. There's some small things like the way our PubSub, the way our notifiers work, like they're transaction aware. So like if you use PubSub with your Phoenix app and you like run a context function inside of a transaction and it has a PubSub notifier in it, right? Like you can't do that because the live view somewhere is going to get, oh, hey, there's a new thing created and it's going to look it up and the transaction's not closed yet. And it doesn't exist for that live view, right? We solve those kinds of problems, lots of little things like that. In terms of like what would be not reasonable for you to build on your own, though, is where we get into some of the things that our policies do. And if we're going deep for it, if we're like going for the deep cuts, I mean, then field policies are like just wildly powerful. So we have a thing called field policies where you can say, given these conditions of the data, you're allowed to see, you know, different fields, or given these conditions of the actor or the query or whatever, right? So an example there is like, you can only see a user's email if they're you. Like if your ID matches their ID, then you can see the email. But let's say you have like a list user's endpoint and you want to expose like filtering by email on that endpoint. Because maybe like an admin, let's say add another condition here that an admin can see everybody's emails, but a non-admin can only see their own email, right? So you can lock down that endpoint if you want, but you actually don't have to if you're using Ash policies and Ash field policies. Because if a user, for instance, visits that, let's say a non-admin user visits that endpoint, and the only user row that they're allowed to see is themselves, for example, that's the only one that'll come back. So they have like a user management endpoint for just the users that they can see. It doesn't really matter. But at the same time, let's say they can see all the users, but only their user should have their email filled in. So they type in this little filter box at the top, you know, like find users by email, and they type in somebody else's email, right? Well, you have to make sure that filter doesn't return them, like, you know, if they type in my email and then my row shows up, but with a blank email, right? This is a real kind of bug. This is a real attack that happens in applications all the time. But the way that field policies work in Ash is, it's very difficult to explain this properly, but if you refer to a field in a filter, we replace that field with a case statement of, if you're allowed to see it, then the field value, otherwise null. So you can actually have like these arbitrarily filterable endpoints and field policies that conditionally lock down access, and the user will always see fields they can't see as if they were empty values consistently across every way that you might access that field. It will look empty displayed in a UI. It will look empty displayed in a filter. And that sort of thing is like, the truth is not a lot of people are like, I would suggest most people who benefit from this feature have no idea that they are benefiting from it. Like it sort of just works and, you know, they don't have a problem. But building that by hand without all of the policy infrastructure that we have, that we've set up, the way we do solving, the way we can translate a policy to a filter that we could then means we translate it to an expression that can be placed in, you know, put in place of a field, all that sort of stuff, right? Like it only works because we know everything about your app. We know all of the fields that are available, all of the rules for seeing them, and we can massage any of the data structures going into running a query before they actually run. So that would, I think, is an example. I don't know if that's like the most impressive example, but it is probably the one that you would almost certainly never make yourself.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. I remember you talking a little bit about like GraphQL and data loader type stuff as well, where just how to sort of optimize loading data is also one of those things like, oh, we have a GraphQL API and everything's nice. And then it's like, oh, this is actually slow. And that is just like a painful process of optimizing, where I think Ash also takes care of a lot of it. Now I'm curious. So if the fields are always treated as empty, if you make a filter that is like, get me all the users with empty email addresses, and you have access to no user's email address, will you get all of those users as if
their email sent? I mean, you will, yeah. But the way to phrase that is like, you have field policies in addition to row level policies, or like to record policies, and those things will always be applied properly. So like, if there's users that you shouldn't be able to see that they exist, they will never come back from a query. So you have those two interactions. It's like that the only time, if you say filter email is null or nil or whatever, right, and you get back a user, you are getting,
it's
back
because you have access to parts of the user.
Yeah, exactly. And so to you, the email does look like nil. Like that's what it's, how it's displayed to you.
Yeah, that's kind of funny, but a very unusual case to filter on empty that way. All right. I think this is roughly the time we have today. The book will be heading for beta when?
We would love to have it in beta by the end of the year.
By the end of the year. Keep an eye out. End of the year is not that far off. Not trying to stress you out, but telling the listeners keep an eye out. Don't forget about it. And all right. Thank you so much, Zach and Rebecca, for coming on the show. This has been a lovely time. And I get more sort of frustrated that I have to learn a new thing every time I talk about Ash, but I definitely need to learn more of it. And I'm very excited by Igniter. I think that has immense potential and also solves a lot of the Ash on-ramp problems. So good combo. And as always, thank you to our sponsors, Lundajord and Groxio. And catch you next time on Beam Radio.